News, I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Trump's announcement of his long-awaited proposal on immigration on Thursday. AP Sagar Magani has details.
In a sunny Rose Garden, the president skipped much of his usual hardline rhetoric and said the new policy will both secure the southern border and recruit top talent to America, which he says is left out in a system favoring family-based immigration.
We discriminate against genius. We discriminate against brilliance.
He says his plan will favor those with high-level skills and degrees, not those with relatives here. The president alternately called for Democrats to back the plan and said they support lawless chaos. Republicans have yet to embrace it, never mind Democrats, and the prospects of a deal seem bleak as next year's election approaches. Sagar Magani at the White House.
President Trump's luxury Trump International Hotel, Washington, D.C., housed in the historic old post office pavilion building, raked in nearly $41 million last year, a tad higher than a previous year, according to Trump's latest financial disclosure filed with the Office of Government Ethics and released Thursday. Those who have questioned the source of the president's income are now asking just how much of the revenue at the Washington Hotel comes from foreign and state government officials. Several foreign embassies have reportedly hosted functions there at a cost of several $100,000. Some watchdog agencies are questioning whether Trump may be in violation of a little-known clause of the U.S. Constitution that prohibits officials from accepting gifts or emoluments from foreign and state government officials without congressional approval. Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido confirmed Thursday he sent a team of negotiators to Norway to help mediate the crisis in the South American country, but denied that they were in talks with representatives of President Nicolas Maduro's government. This is VOA News. Police have dismantled a major cybercrime ring that stole millions of dollars worldwide. We get more from Reuters' Joe Davies.
The defendants allegedly operated on underground, Russian-speaking online criminal forums, advertising their specialist technical skills. They were recruited by the Gosnam network leader, a man from Tbilisi in Georgia. Together, they're suspected of infecting their victims' computers with malware designed to capture their online banking logins and stealing money, which was then laundered to accounts controlled by them. They're accused of stealing an estimated $100 million from more than 41,000 victims. Europol said five Russians charged in the US indictment remain at large. The leader of the criminal network and his technical assistant are being prosecuted in Georgia. They've been stopped, but the task of bringing the most sophisticated of criminal gangs to justice remains.
That's Reuters' Joe Davies reporting. President Trump says that he hopes the United States is not going to war with Iran amid rising tensions in the Middle East. AP's Ed Donahue reports members of Congress are asking for more information as well.
An aircraft carrier and bombers have been sent to the Middle East. At the White House, a question for President Trump. Congressional leaders received a classified briefing on Iran. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham wants to know more.
And I would tell the administration you should pick up the phone and call members of Congress so that we don't have a microphone put in our face. Ask us about why you're doing something when we have no clue.
Connecticut Democrat Richard Blumenthal says he's been told he will be briefed on Iran Tuesday.
It may be too late, because hostilities may have begun.
Blumenthal says Americans are getting a confused and chaotic picture of what's going on in the Middle East. Ed Donahue, Washington.
The Senate in the state of Missouri is the latest U.S. state legislative body to act in favor of a restricted abortion bill, bolstering a national movement Republicans hope could lead to the revocation of the landmark 1973 decision that legalized abortion. The Republican-led Senate in the Midwestern state voted 24-10 early Thursday to ban abortions after 8 weeks of pregnancy. The legislation includes exceptions for medical emergencies, but not for pregnancies caused by incest or rape. The state's Republican-led House must approve the measure before it goes to the Republican governor, Mike Parson, for him to sign into law. Parson voiced support for that bill on Wednesday. Find more at voanews.com, I'm Tommy McNeil, the VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 17th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Burkina Faso calls for an international coalition to fight Sahel terrorism.
The member states of the G5 Sahel cannot succeed alone. It is therefore time for the international community to consider creating an international coalition to better tackle the phenomenon of terrorism in the G5 Sahel and throughout the rest of the Sahel.
That's Burkina Faso Foreign Minister Alpha Barry speaking through an interpreter. Cameroon villagers form militias and arrest suspected separatists. African military commanders ask the UN to change its peacekeeping policy. Al-Shabaab militants reportedly are demanding a $1.5 million ransom to release two kidnapped Cuban doctors. And Nigeria's opposition PDP denies allegations it is plotting to overthrow President Buhari.
I want to place it on record that His Excellency Atiku Abubakar is not one that is interested, can be interested, will ever be interested in anything that will destabilize this country.
Segun Suwome is the spokesman for former Nigerian Vice President Atiku Abubakar, and the Red Cross appeals for more funding for Ebola response in the DRC. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Foreign Minister of Burkina Faso has called on the international community to consider creating a counter-terrorism coalition like the ones for Iraq and Afghanistan to better combat terrorism in Africa's Sahel region. VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir has details.
The African region currently has the G5 Sahel Joint Force, which includes troops from Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger. Those troops are tasked with fighting the threat from extremist and armed groups. But in the 2 years since its creation, the force has faced major delays and obstacles, including the car bombing of its headquarters. The UN says it is now 75% operational, but that ongoing equipment and training shortfalls are slowing down its progress toward full operational capacity. The Sahel also has 16,000 UN peacekeepers in Mali and 3,000 French troops based in Chad to help restore stability. But despite the presence of these three forces, Burkina Faso Foreign Minister Alpha Barry told the Security Council the situation caused by terrorism and intercommunal violence is worrisome and deteriorating. He's heard here through an interpreter.
This threat is gaining ground. It's no longer contained within the north of Mali, in the Burkina-based Sahel, or far from the borders of Mauritania. It is spreading and taking other forms whose consequences are equally dramatic.
Barry noted the recent attacks on Christian churches in his country, an attack on Niger's military this week that killed 28 soldiers, and the abduction and rescue operation of four foreign tourists in northern Benin to illustrate the scope of the threat. The minister said one of the main drivers of insecurity on the continent is the civil war in Libya, which is fueling terrorism and the proliferation of guns. He said the Sahel nations require greater assistance as the security challenges are likely to be long-term.
Regarding the urgency of the actions to be undertaken, the member states of the G5 Sahel cannot succeed alone. It is therefore time for the international community to consider creating an international coalition to better tackle the phenomenon of terrorism in the G5 Sahel and throughout the rest of the Sahel.
Dozens of countries participated in the Afghanistan and Iraq coalitions. They fought the Taliban in Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda in Iraq for many years and at the cost of thousands of lives and billions of dollars. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Nigeria's opposition People's Democratic Party, the PDP, is refuting allegations that its presidential candidate in the last election, former Vice President Atiku Abubakar, has been plotting to overthrow President Muhammadu Buhari. PDP spokesman Segun Suwome says the allegations are regrettably false. During a news conference Thursday in Abuja, Nigerian Information Minister Lai Mohammed warned that former Vice President Abubakar risks being charged with treason if he does not stop his alleged plans to destabilize the country. The warning came after Nigeria's Chief of Army Staff, Lieutenant General Tuku Yusuf Buratai, says that politicians are behind the ongoing security challenges that the country faces. Segun Suwome is the spokesman for former Vice President Atiku Abubakar.
I want to place it on record that His Excellency Atiku Abubakar is not one that is interested, can be interested, will ever be interested in anything that will destabilize this country, let alone create an avalanche of crisis that can cause Nigerians to lose their lives or for the Nigerian state not to be well. So I want to advise President Muhammadu Buhari to rein in his dogs and prevent them from continuing with this provocative, annoying, unacceptable victimization, harassment, and aggression towards the person of His Excellency Atiku Abubakar. We want to say that if there is any evidence that anybody is investigating crime in the country, some people should be investigated and all that. But we pray and we call the attention of the international community and all men of good conscience that they should please advise them to leave His Excellency Atiku Abubakar and his team completely out of all of this.
The information minister called on the PDP and Alhaji Atiku Abubakar to either retrace their steps or face treasonous charges. How do you respond to that?
I will just say that, like I described it as frustration, aggression, displacement theory, part of the activities, part of the things you see with people who are in a democracy, but would rather be maximum rulers in a dictatorship, is to dangle treason and dangle incarceration and dangle many and dangle death before members of their country, before the leader of opposition in their country. And I will want to advise that that is an ill wind that is not going to do anyone any good.
The Chief of Army Staff, General Buratai, said some politicians are behind the insecurity in the country and that the government will take decisive actions. What is your reaction to this statement coming from the Chief of Army Staff?
I will just say that I, as a very trained, well-trained military officer, I expect that if he makes a comment, that comment will be taken very, very seriously, and that investigation, thorough investigation and proper investigation will be appropriate. But I must add, they must not lend the country to crisis by insisting that victimization and scapegoatism is going to be their brush to cover incompetence and lack of proper approach to serious security challenges. We hold that the security challenges in the country, though not being easy, are challenges that require a deeper revealing and a deeper reviewing of our structures will help. Whatever be the case, it's too simplistic to say that political people are. But I will not discountenance everything he has said, because I want to believe that the training and the responsibilities and the fact that he is the one who's putting his men in arms way means that he must look for credible evidence. Those who are involved must be named, they must be shamed, and the country must be allowed to enjoy peace and security.
Shehu Suwomi is the spokesman for former Nigerian Vice President Atiku Abubakar. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. The Somalia-based Al-Shabaab militant group has reportedly demanded a $1.5 million ransom for the release of two Cuban doctors who were kidnapped last month in Kenya. According to local Kenya media reports, a group of elders from the Kenyan Somali community went to Somalia to negotiate the release of the doctors. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
On a phone interview by the Mandera County Commission, Kutsua Olaka, he refuted claims that the Al-Shabaab was in need of the money. Olaka, however, refused to give detailed information on the matter. I don't have any message. I have no reports. I don't have any information about that issue. Even if it's in the media, I don't have any information. Kenyan government security officials failed to comment on the matter too. According to the Daily Nation newspaper in Kenya, elders from Mandera and Bulahalo in Somalia had been sent to the village located between Buale and El Ad to negotiate for the release of doctors. The elders have confirmed that the two doctors are alive and offering treatment to the community in a restricted area controlled by Al-Shabaab. Following the abduction, Cuban doctors posted in attack-prone areas such as Wajir, Lamu, Garissa, and Tana River were recalled and reassigned in different areas. The Cuban doctors are working in Kenya on special arrangement between the governments of Cuba and Kenya. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, May 17th, Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. English-speaking Cameroonians who say they are fed up with an ongoing separatist war are taking matters into their own hands by arresting and handing over suspected separatist fighters to the military. Some residents also have created militias in their respective towns and villages as they voice frustration over the war that has killed close to 2,000 people. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
In the English-speaking village of Pinyin, a man shouts alongside scores of people who voice jubilation over the arrest of four suspected fighters. Among the residents is 45-year-old Bucha Peter Ndifo, a village self-defense group member. Ndifo says he participated in the arrests because the situation has worsened by the day since the war started in 2017. He says people are dying and businesses are crumbling.
At first, we used to slaughter about 5-6 cow a day. But presently now, we slaughter just one or two, but it cannot even get finished again. It has affected my business a lot.
The suspected separatists, armed with locally made guns, were overpowered by the huge crowd that attacked their hideout. The four men did not shoot, but received severe beatings before they were handed to the military. Separatists have said on social media that the arrested men are not their fighters. They say the armed men may either have been taking advantage of the fight to kidnap people for ransom or were sent by the government to disguise themselves as fighters in order to attack and give information to the military. Cameroon's unrest began in 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers protested the growing dominance of the French language in the officially bilingual country. The government responded with a crackdown, and separatists began using weapons against the military, alleging that they were defending their people and fighting for their independence. Political analyst Gilbert Mba says many people have voiced irritation with the war because there is no end in sight and conditions are worsening.
The population is really fed up with it. Not 3 years, it's not 3 days. The economy is really down. Children in the house, no food, no school, everything. I mean, it's really very bad.
Cameroon has been using village militias on its northern border with Nigeria to fight Boko Haram terrorists with the hope the armed locals can prevent further attacks. Paul Atanganji, Cameroon's Minister of Territorial Administration, says the government is relying on such groups to defend their communities from intruders.
Look at what is happening in the far north region. The vigilante groups are very operational because there's that synergy between the vigilante groups and the forces of law and order. When the suicide bombers are coming, they go and stop them.
The militias live on donations and expect support from the government. The violence has also kept more than 600,000 children out of school and disrupted healthcare services as well as the economy. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Several African military commanders meeting in Rwanda's capital, Kigali, have urged the United Nations to change its policy, which they say causes delays in peacekeeping missions rescue in Africa. As Eugene Uwimana reports from Kigali, the commanders made the call at the closing of the National Security Symposium held in the Rwandan capital.
This is Rwanda's Chief Defense Staff, General Patrick Nyamvumba. From 2009 to 2013, he served in Sudan as force commander of the AU-UN hybrid operation Darfur. He's recording an incident where one of his soldiers was taken hostage by rebels while commanders of hybrid operation delayed their rescue.
Now, one thing that I learned in the UN, if you do not exercise personal restraint, it is very easy that you could lose your mind.
Experts say such delays or unjust decisions by the UN peacekeeping mission have resulted to several failures and the loss of lives in different parts of Africa. The genocide perpetrated against the Tutsi in 1994 is cited as a tangible example. In 1994, UN decided to withdraw its troops while atrocities were being committed. Ambassador Jean-Pierre François Lacroix, the UN Under-Secretary General, says who recognize the problem, adds that nowadays the conflict environment has changed.
In most of the places that I mentioned, the peacekeepers are targeted, not in spite of being UN, but because they are UN. But they're targeted because the groups and the individuals, the parties that are in the business of derailing peace efforts have no interest in seeing peacekeepers succeed. Actually, they have a lot of interest in seeing them fail.
The African Union believes there's one solution to this problem of bureaucracy, which is to fund the AU's own peacekeeping missions. But Ambassador Hadiza Mustafa, advisor to the chairperson of African Union Commission on Peace and Security, says the funds are still the hindrance.
Even though we deploy, we do not have the capacity. So a lot of what we do, a lot of the deployment, we have to depend on external funding. Have to take responsibility for our, because internationally, globally, there is no much appetite now for aid, for help.
According to the UN report, as of now, it has 14 peacekeeping missions worldwide, with over 110,000 peacekeepers from 120 countries. But the UN says that its missions in Africa are becoming more deadly. In 2017 alone, there were at least 56 UN personnel killed, the highest number since 1994. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, the IFRC, has appealed to the international community to urgently increase funding for its Ebola response efforts in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The organization has been leading the efforts for the safe burial of Ebola victims. Richard Blewitt is the permanent observer for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies to the United Nations. He says since August last year, the Red Cross has conducted 5,000 burials, an average of 20 per day.
The main work of the Democratic Republic of Congo Red Cross, the Federation and the International Committee of the Red Cross is concerning safe burial and dignified burial and reaching communities and making sure they understand what Ebola is and building trust so that they can believe the medical response is going to actually save lives. Now, there's been a 20% increase of more than 1,600 cases have occurred in the past 3 weeks. Overall, the number of people have died is over 1,100. So we're just very concerned that this is a very significant outbreak with quite a wide geography in a very difficult place.
One of the things you do is to help bury the victims of this Ebola crisis. Just how many people do you think you bury per day or something like that?
So overall, we've been involved in the safe burial of over 4,380 burials since August the 1st last year. And we provide training to communities that also enable them to do it and to see that it's still dignified, it's in line with their culture.
This appeal you are making, how much money do you think your organization needs to continue the work you're doing?
We need another over 20 million Swiss francs. It's more than that. Really, we need the overall response to be scaling up at the community level in a very difficult environment. And so we need other actors also that have the trust of communities to be reaching those communities with us to basically bring this terrible challenge of Ebola under control.
As you mentioned that recently the number of cases in the DRC reached a milestone, 1,000 or so more. To what degree does this high number now affect your work?
Well, I think the spike is of real concern, both in terms of the fact that it's now affecting quite a wide geography, and therefore, you know, it's not just in one location, but it's in a whole range of locations. We are actually worried about neighboring countries, and we've been working with the ministries of health in neighboring countries to be prepared and organized to do the right thing. And we can't let this go on. You know, I think the international community has the resources and I'm sure has the will. I was with the ambassador to the UN, the American ambassador for Canada today, who are showing, I think, good solidarity and interest in putting more resources to support us and other actors in bringing this under control.
The story I have says that since August last year, you have done at least 5,000 burials, amounted to maybe 20 per day on average. How much does it cost to bury someone who has died from Ebola?
About $500 US, because, I mean, it's obviously all the training, the equipment, the transport. There's a cost to it. It's not an enormous cost in the sum of, you know, bringing this dreadful disease under control quickly. And I think we've learned how to do it through the experiences we had earlier in West Africa. And now we're bringing that experience to bear. And I think the big thrust needs to be that the whole international community needs to move in that direction.
Richard Bledwood is the permanent observer for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies to the United Nations. He was speaking with me from New York City. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in athletics, where Jamaican retired sprinter and world record holder in the 100 meters, 200 meters and 4x100 meters relay, Usain Bolt, has urged South African's Caster Semenya to accept the new rules of the International Athletics Federation on testosterone levels. Bolt spoke on the sidelines of the launch of his electric scooter brand, where he said the decision of the IAAF is just the rules.
For me, that's just rules. I've said it over the years. You know what I mean? I don't make the rules. You know what I mean? When he made the rules, I just follow the rules.
In the meantime, Kenya's Olympic 800 meters bronze medalist, Margaret Nyairira, can feel her career slipping away from her with no idea when or if she will be able to compete internationally again. The 24-year-old is one of the several star female athletes affected by an International Association of Athletics Federation ruling this month that requires women with high levels of testosterone to take medication to suppress it. Nyairira said she had never faced questions about her gender or appearance until the IAAF began cracking down on women with elevated testosterone.
For me, I'm not going to take medication because I'm not sick. And to tell us now to take medication, those are chemicals that you're putting on your body, of which you don't know at the end of it what will come to affect you later.
Staying with athletics, but this time in Nigeria, where the West African country is facing an imminent ban by the World Athletics ruling body IAAF following the misappropriation of a $150,000 grant paid to the Athletics Federation of Nigeria. The IAAF had paid the amount in error to the AFN account, but rather than refund the excess $135,000, the AFN and sports ministry officials in Nigeria decided to appropriate the money after they got approval from top echelons of the sports ministry. The IAAF, in a letter addressed to the AFN and signed by G. Isram, who is a senior manager, governance, members and international relations, reminded the Federation of the need to pay up the money within 2 weeks or Nigeria will face appropriate sanctions. In football news, Bayana coach Destry Ellis will announce her final squad for the 2019 FIFA World Cup in France later this weekend, following her last assessment of the team in a competitive match against the United States of America. The team arrived in South Africa ahead of their final preparations for the World Cup, having suffered a 3-0 defeat at the hands of the number one ranked nation in the world.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend, and we look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, summary of Africa news. The foreign minister of Burkina Faso has called on the international community to consider creating a counter-terrorism coalition like the ones for Iraq and Afghanistan to better combat terrorism in Africa's Sahel region. And that is it for this Friday, May 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. I'm James Botte on behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, wishing you a very, very good weekend.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa news. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
Hey,
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.